interest may contain graphic and disturbing subject matter. This is a horror true crime comedy podcast, and the topics may depict murder, abuse, the supernatural, and things that should never be involved with food. Our hosts dive deep into the internet for their research and do their best not to screw up the pronunciations. All jokes are made with the utmost respect to those involved, and listener discretion is advised. Hi all, this is Regina here. I just want to thank you for hanging in there with us for these first handful of episodes while we learn our audio equipment. Just hang in there with us and I promise we'll get better. Hello everyone, all of you disturbed out there. Welcome back to Disturbing Interest. I am Regina King, your evil queen, and sitting next to me is my lovely co-host,
Lynn, the Docent of Darkness.
That's right.
And we're actually going to talk about art history, kinda, today.
We're talking about a lot of shit today. In fact, folks, this is your first two-parter with Disturbing Interest.
I know, we went deep down the rabbit hole of history with all of this. And disturbing history.
And Neko is up on the desk being the podcat. You'll probably hear her in the background. Don't mess with the wires, Neko. Don't mess with the wires.
She's like, I'm the sound tech, man.
So if the sound is off today, we're going to blame Neko. Oh, I've got an update for you.
At least our
listeners, because you've heard this already, but our listeners have not.
You're in for a treat. A creepy, creepy treat.
So a few episodes back, I mentioned that my sister, her nickname is The Hulk, so we are just going to call her The Hulk. I called her to make sure that I got the details of the body parts in the bag story correct. And I did, but her response was, well, Mom told you about the ribcage, right?
That's not a phrase you hear a lot.
No, it's not. To which my response was, what ribcage? And she tells me the story. She was watching her friend's house out in Rio Grande while they were on vacation. And for any of you who does not know where Rio Grande is, it's kind of like Central Coast California, hills, middle of nowhere, lots of stables and farms and things like that.
Bucolic splendor?
Yes. Yes. Vineyards. Yeah. So she's out there in this area with nothing around her, just running. From the house, she ran out into the hills, foothills of California. Tiny, tiny, tiny. She's like 112 pounds, soaking wet. Beautiful, but tiny woman. So she's running along, and all of a sudden she looks over, and she thinks to herself, oh my, that looks like a ribcage. And my sister is in the medical field, and has been in the medical field since I was like 12, I think. So she knows what a ribcage looks like, especially being a respiratory therapist. It's kind of her go-to area.
The ribcage is her business.
Yes. So she looks over and she's like, oh my, I think that's a ribcage. And I was like, wait a minute. You found a ribcage, like a human ribcage? And she goes, well, I started convincing myself it was a deer ribcage. And I was like, okay, well, what'd you do? She said, well, I turned around and decided my run was over. I had gone far enough. And she ran as fast as she fucking could back to that house. Because, of course, that's what you do.
If you find a rib cage, yeah, you might want to beat feet out of there.
Yeah. So I ask her, she called the cops, because personally, if I find a fucking rib cage, even if I think it's a deer's, I'm calling the cops.
Yeah, that seems legit.
Right?
Yeah, you want to be a crime stopper, not a crime helper.
Especially in areas where quite a few women have gone missing. Like, there are some prominent missing women cases from right around that time period out there. So, yeah, I would have called the cops. However, we were raised by an intense, amazing woman. But her thing was, you don't talk to the cops. So, of course, my sister, yet again, did not call the cops. And
Johnny 5-0 is not your friend.
No. And so she told me this, and I was like, so you're telling me that there are probably two times where there were human bodies left out, dumped by some killer that you ran across and could have made somebody aware of it, possibly found a loved one, and you didn't?
Just noped out?
She just noped the fuck out. So yeah, that's my sister. Apparently, if you are a body out there and she comes across you, she's not reporting it.
So she's not going to be recruited for necro search anytime soon.
No.
No.
Well, I mean, maybe the search, but not the report.
She'll find them. She's not going to tell anybody.
Exactly.
Just keep that to yourself.
Yep. So, my sister, She may come back in the next life as a cadaver dog. She'd be good with that.
She could find him. She's not telling nobody.
That's right.
I'm kind of curious, like, what the percentage is of people, like, in the United States who have found a body, like, a human body. Like one out of, I don't know how many, 50, one out of 100, one out of 10. I mean, I guess probably it depends on where you live, but I'm kind of curious, like, how many people have run across something kind of creepy and sketchy like that at some point in their lives.
Not only am I curious about that, but I want to know, like, what's that skew percentage of people who don't report it?
Right? The people are like, oh, nope, not talking to the cops there.
Yeah, the people who are like the Hulk, that are just like, nope, just going to run the opposite way.
I just feel like I'm such Cindy Sue straight and narrow that I would be like, oh my goodness, I need to get home and report this right away.
Oh, you know I would. I would be like, fuck this. I'm running as fast as I... Well, first off, let's face it. I would not be out running.
Oh, yeah. I only run when chased. Mm. Like, unless you've got, like, you're dangling, I don't know, a margarita on a string in front of me, or there's a guy in a clown suit with a machete behind me. I'm not running. I feel like what we've learned from this story is don't go running.
That is a good takeaway, yes.
Or exercise indoors in a non-cadaver-filled gymnasium area.
Let's hope there aren't cadavers in the gymnasium.
Yeah, no, one hopes not.
Yeah, so update on my sister. She has a habit of finding dead bodies.
Yeah. And not reporting them.
Yes, yes. I actually have something for you.
For me?
For you.
Uh-oh. A thing?
First, I have a question.
Okay.
What goes perfectly... Like, when out of all the foods, when you ask somebody what would go perfectly with meat, what would they say?
Marzipan.
Well, not us. Normal people.
Normal people? What goes with meat? Is it potatoes?
It is. Now, if you were asking us, what would we say?
It would be marzipan.
Of course.
Marzipan potatoes! Marzipan kartoffeln! Oh! Yes, this is a classic. This is a classic what the fuck is wrong with you Germany dessert. Yes, oh yes. They look like potatoes. They basically look like little brown balls. Like little, like, roasty potatoes. But they're actually made out of delicious sweet marzipan. And, I have no idea why this is a thing in Germany, but it's absolutely a thing. Yes.
I saw those in the store, and I was just like, oh my god.
These are delightful. I'm going to take these home and just traumatize the hell out of my poor, poor spouse. Weirdly enough, he is a German that does not care for marzipan. Maybe that's why he lives here. I don't know.
Could be.
Yeah, he's not allowed to return to the fatherland because of his marzipan hate. But yeah, no, it's a thing, as are weird confections of Germany are a beautiful thing. Now, they are outstanding at putting booze inside chocolate, so high five to you, Germany, for that gorgeous marriage of sins.
Indeed.
But then there are these little bugs called kefir. They're not like real actual insects, but little beetles that are made out of like choco and things like that, so you can eat a delicious bug. Yep. Yeah. Yep. Oh, there's all manner. And then pigs, marzipan pigs, that is also a big
That's a big thing.
Oh my god, don't fuck with the marzipan pig.
I don't understand that one at all. Like,
I will never understand. Maybe it goes with your potatoes. Maybe you feed the marzipan potatoes to the marzipan pig. And then, I don't know. I'm not sure where that goes from there. But you fatten it up for then roasting the marzipan. I don't know. I don't know.
Anyway, so I had to get those for you when I saw it. Oh, this is
beautiful. I'm very excited. I'm going to go home and just kind of tuck these under Will's pillow. So he'll be like, what in the name of Christ is... Yeah, like
it's that. Following me.
Oh, I'm so excited, too, because again, what does... Well, not so much Germany, but Austria have around the Christmas season. Krampus.
Oh, yes.
And I'm working on my Krampus suit for this year, because I work in tourism, and I would like to just make Christmas weird at Pike Place Market. Not that it's not already just weird enough being there. Like, do we have a Christmas tree? Yeah, we have some trees, but what is our big thing that we light up down there? It's a carrot. We light up a big-ass carrot, because...
This is Seattle, folks.
Because it's a carrot. Of course we do.
There's also a giant squid down there.
Oh, it's a giant squid. There's a wall covered in gum. I like to think of that as the hepatitis wall that people want to come down and take a picture in front of. It just gives me the shivers thinking about it.
I have a picture in front of that wall, and I was not okay with it. I'm smiling in the picture, but in my soul, I was screaming.
I just look at it and I think, you know what really needs the cleansing power of fire? This fucker. Yeah, it absolutely horrifies me. Yeah.
Yeah, there was a wall like that in San Luis Obispo. I'm sure it's probably still there. Hey, all you out there in San Luis Obispo listening, or people who might know, if that wall is still there, go ahead and write us, disturbinginterest@gmail.com, and title it Gross Ass Wall.
I'm just really happy that I work at the actual exact opposite of the market from the gum wall, so I try to avoid going down there, except if I'm going to Ghost Alley Espresso, because that shit is delicious, really? And is the locally roasted right there at the market coffee place. I know everybody's excited about the first Starbucks, which, let me just crap in your parade, there isn't actually. It's the first Starbucks outlet, but the original Starbucks offices no longer exist. And it's the same coffee. Seriously. It's the very same Frappuccino your ass is going to get in Des Moines, Iowa.
Yep.
Gonna get right there. It just looks a little bit, I don't know, browner inside than a fancy regular one.
The shop just looks different. But yeah. You know what? I'm all about supporting Starbucks. I mean, hell, when we were down in Cozumel over the summer, we found the one Starbucks right there that we could go and get something to drink at. And it was delightful. It was just absolutely delightful. It was the same there as it was here. So Starbucks, way to go on your consistency. I do appreciate you for that.
And they do seem to do really pretty well by their employees. You know, they seem to try.
They do. I have a friend who works for them and they treat her really well.
Yeah, I just feel like in Seattle, if you're going to be in the coffee mecca, and you need the coffee here because it's really depressing, like, 10 months of the year in terms of lack of sunlight. Okay, 9 months of the year. It's really grim and dark here, and you're going to want a little pick-me-up, and cocaine is illegal, so coffee, there you go. It's sort of like, go to a fancy French restaurant and you go full Trump and go, I want a well-done steak and ketchup. That's not what you do. You're here.
Your Trump impression, it makes me so happy.
Try something better. I really try to get that whole, like, you know, that whole, like, cat anus kind of look.
You do.
Jowly, I really kind of bring it out there.
It's just wonderful. It just makes my day.
I'll have to tell you one day about the time my mom accidentally met Donald Trump.
You have told me, but you will have to definitely tell
the
listeners.
Someday. Yes. Someday.
So.
She's not a Trump support. No, not at a rally. My mom does not have a MAGA hat. My mom was a Bernie Sanders lady. So don't send us angry mail. No. But she did accidentally run into Donald Trump a number of years ago at a family wedding, and that was weird.
That is
super
weird.
That
is super weird. So, you want to get us kicked off today?
Oh, yes. So this is our double episode, our double header, and we try to keep things kind of consistent between our two stories. And our topic for this two-parter are homicidal women. And mine is actually an attempted homicidal woman with an art history bent to it. Thank goodness she was not successful at the homicide, but her story is a really fascinating one. And I will tell you about Valerie Solanas, the woman who shot Andy Warhol.
Ooh, I'm so excited.
I know. It's art history, so it's okay that we're talking about really horrible things, right?
It's always okay we're talking about really horrible things. This is our show.
But this is classy. We're put the gloss of class over this one. So, for listeners who may not be familiar with Andy Warhol, and, you know, I don't know your life. Some of y'all are really into art. Some of you are like, the hell is that?
I don't know you.
I don't know your life. So, if you are familiar with Andy Warhol, like, take the next 3 minutes, go fix yourself a snack, go have a glass of wine, you know, walk the dog, have some marzipan, do what you need to do. And then come on back when I'm done. Or, you know, feel free to hang out and be like, well, you're not talking about this, blah, blah, blah. This is the quick and dirty. This is for listeners who are like, I think I heard that name before, but I don't really know him. So you'll know Andy Warhol as the soup can guy. So basically, Andy Warhol, he was born Andrew Warhola in 1928, but he dropped...
Solid choice.
Warhola, yes.
He was quite the Warhola.
He was Hugh Warhola, but he dropped the A in his last name for... probably obvious reasons. But old Andy grew up in Pittsburgh, as did I. So props to the Steel City. With parents who had emigrated from Slovakia. This family was hardcore old school Pittsburgh. From Eastern Europe? Check. Dad worked in a coal mine? Check. Steel mill is also an appropriate answer. Father died in a horrible accident when Andy was a boy? Check.
Jeez.
Mom was super Catholic? Check. So he is hitting on all the Pittsburgh cylinders right there. But Andy was kind of a sickly kid who spent a lot of time confined to bed. thanks to having St. Vitus's Dance, which was a nervous system disease that caused involuntary jerking of the extremities.
Wow.
Yeah, and this is, again, this is from Scarlet Fever, so people don't tend to get this kind of thing these days because...
How bad is it that I just really want to make an off-color joke about jerking extremities?
That's keeping it classy, Regina. Keeping it real classy.
You know, yeah. Fish gotta swim.
Oh. But basically, he was kind of a sickly kid in a time and a place that was not geared toward the sickly.
Or kids. Children's rights were not a thing back then.
No, Pittsburgh was like a seriously... Pittsburgh's hardcore. But anyway, you know, he was a sickly kid, spent a lot of time in bed, kind of discovered that he really liked art and kind of drawing and this sort of interior life while he was kind of confined to his sick bed, and then decided that he would attend art school. So he went to Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh, whoop whoop, and he studied commercial art because you could at least sort of theoretically make some money.
It's what you did.
And then he promptly took the fuck off, peaced out to New York City because you would have too at that time if you were both artistic and a little bit gay. So his early career was in advertising art, and he even became a shoe designer in the 1950s for Israel Miller. He learned silk screening at the time, and that would become a huge deal for him later in his fine arts work. He was also a big fan of tracing images from photographs, but then kind of subtly changing and doing some interesting things with the lines. Again, very important to his later work. He started exhibiting his work actually in fine art galleries in New York and then on the West Coast in the late 50s and early 60s. And he loved making images of iconic American objects, doing what they called pop art at the time. So he would make silkscreen images of things like Campbell's soup cans, which is probably what he's best known for. Or he'd make like Brillo pad boxes, like you would find, you know, getting ready to stock shelves in a grocery store. But he would make these into art objects that he would then sell for hundreds and hundreds of dollars, which just freaked out, pissed off, and generally incensed the kind of cultural culturati, as it were. But he also really loved celebrity culture. And so he would take iconic photographs and film stills of people like Marlon Brando, Marilyn Monroe, Elvis, Liz Taylor, and he would silkscreen them in multiple images on like the same canvas in bright, interesting pop colors.
The Marilyn Monroe piece has been seen and filmed and photographed so many times, all over the place. It is a staple of pop art and in pop culture. And I'm sure those of you out there who don't realize, you know who Andy Warhol is or was.
You know him.
You know him.
You've seen his work. Or you've seen rip-offs, knockoffs, satires, takeoffs of his work.
The Madonna one that came out.
Absolutely, yeah. So I'm guessing you've all at least seen something like that. Well, at this time, in the mid-60s, he also founded his famous studio, The Factory. So The Factory was this big kind of industrial space in New York City down in the 40s, and it was painted silver inside. It was in Manhattan, Lower Manhattan, and he assembled this huge revolving cast of assistants, hangers-on, general factotums, and superstars. Which is what he called these folks that he put in his movies and that kind of swirled around him in the factory. And some of the superstars were people like Nico and Lou Reed from the Velvet Underground. That was kind of like the house band over at the factory.
Wow. Can you imagine your house band just being the Velvet Underground?
The Velvet Underground. Oh, yeah. Edie Sedgwick is another name you might recognize. She was a real kind of a fashion icon, an it girl look of that 60s with that kind of little pixie hairdo, really thin, giant eyelashes, big eyes, that kind of look.
Waify.
A waif, yes. And then also people like Candy Darling, Holly Woodlawn, Jackie Curtis, who were real pioneers of the transgender movement in America. I don't know, movement is the word, but were pioneering people that happened to be transgender.
They were pioneering the lifestyle. They were living their truth.
Yes, they were living who they really were. And remember, this is the 50s and 60s, and this is a time when it's still literally illegal to be gay in America. There were sodomy laws on the books, and they were starting to get rid of those. It was starting to kind of loosen up and get less stupid in the 60s. But again, it still took even until I believe the very early 2000s for all of those laws to be off the books. Which, across the U.S.
I've got to say, hey, anyone out there listening to this that was fighting the good fight, or anyone who had parents who or grandparents or whatever who were there at the time living their truth and fighting for their lifestyle, you know, thank them. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Yeah, so this is sort of a very avant-garde, shocking to kind of regular, you know, kind of boring status quo society group of people. And he also, in addition to making all of this art that was shaking things up, he started making films with his factory superstars. Between 1963 and 1968, which was a very fateful year, as we will find out, he made more than 60 films of varying length.
Really?
Yeah, more than 60 of them, plus around 500 short black and white screen tests of visitors to the factory and of the superstars. So the films that we're talking about that he made were not necessarily commercial or even kind of traditional narrative type films or documentaries or about anything. I mean, plot, what the hell's that? He was just more interested in the vibe of them. So, to quote the Wikipedia article on these films that he made, they included one of his most famous films, Sleep, which monitors poet John Giorno sleeping for 6 hours.
I'm sure. 6 hours?
Yeah. Yeah, I'm sure if you had trouble sleeping, this would be a real good antidote for that.
6 hours?
6 hours.
Damn.
Well, if that's not action-packed enough for you, there's also Empire, which is another really famous one that he did, which consists of just 8 hours of footage of the Empire State Building in New York City at dusk.
I have actually heard of that one before.
You can find excerpts of a lot of these films online, places like YouTube. If you Google them, you can check them out if you would like to yourself experience the just breathtaking joy, the pulse-pounding excitement of an Andy Warhol movie. You can do that. But his most popular film that actually had some box office and critical success was one called Chelsea Girls, which was made in 1966. And it consisted, this is actually kind of an interesting one. If you're going to go with one, check out Chelsea Girls, especially if it's being screened anywhere that is showing it kind of in its original state. It consisted of 2 16-millimeter film reels that were being projected simultaneously. And then up in the sound booth, the sound would be switched from one to the other. And each film reel shows a different story, and they're both being played at once, but depending on where the sound is going, your attention is diverted from one to the other. And it was shot in and around the famous Chelsea Hotel, which will play into our later story on Valerie Solanas.
The Chelsea Hotel.
The Chelsea Hotel, that storied place of legend.
That's something we are going to have to do later on, folks.
Oh, we have to. That place is just like a temple to New York counterculture for just decades. And now it's a luxury boutique hotel.
You know, Travel Channel, if you're out there listening to this, if you wanted to do, let's say, disturbing travels, we are your girls. We got you. We could totally go to the Chelsea Hotel. We can go to many, many places.
Oh, there's so many disturbing locations throughout the world. So hit us up, Travel Channel. We're there for you. Yep. We're ready to host a travel show.
We got this.
I'll bring my own Dramamine. It's going to be great. So we'll move from Andy, who was quite famous, to somebody who later became infamous in his circle. So Valerie Jean Solanas was born on April 9th, 1936, in lovely Ventnor City, New Jersey. So her childhood was not, by her recollection, a particularly happy one. She said that her biological father allegedly, we're going to use the term allegedly.
My favorite word.
Yeah, allegedly, regularly sexually abused her, though other reports from family members suggest differently. Who knows? This is when you're sexually abusing your kid, you're unlikely to just be like, hey, guess what I'm doing tonight, Aunt Martha?
Yeah, that's what I was about to
Fiddling
say.
Fiddling the kid. No.
If you're sexually abusing your child, it's not like you're going to tell your friend.
That is not a thing you're probably going to tell people. But again, we have to say allegedly because we don't know for sure.
Allegedly.
And Valerie definitely is somebody that, let's just say, her idea of the truth may differ from the people around her. She had a lot of mental health issues that worsened the older she got. So I'm not saying I don't believe her. I'm just saying that her perception definitely was one that she was abused.
She might exist on a different plane of existence.
But her story basically is that her father was sexually abusive to her, and her parents divorced, we know this for sure, when she was very young, and she really didn't care for her mother or stepfather. She rebelled against her rather strict upbringing in the time-honored surly kid tradition of skipping school. She also beat up a boy in high school who was picking on a younger girl, and which I'm like, go Valerie in this case. I'm for intervention and stopping bullies in their tracks. If you don't start none, there won't be none, I think is a really good kind of motto for life.
That is a good motto.
Yeah. But she not only did that, she reportedly hit a nun at school.
That's hardcore.
That is hardcore, because nuns, I'm sorry, are real scary. Nuns are scary.
They are. They are. I mean, hell, if they weren't, there wouldn't be a horror movie called The Nun.
Right. There wouldn't be the Magdalene Laundries. Like, nuns have a real history of being some pretty stern ladies. She also, this is my favorite Valerie Solanas childhood story. She was quite the miscreant entrepreneur as a little girl and would write insults for her classmates to use on each other for the cost of a dime apiece.
That is fucking brilliant.
Isn't that great?
That is brilliant.
That's a good use of capitalism right there, Valerie. Well done.
I have friends who have come to me asking me to write insults to people in the past, so I'm kind of relating really hard with Valerie right now.
Yeah, Valerie's slam book. I would totally pick that up. Barnes & Noble.
Yeah.
But she was then sent to live with her grandparents when she was 15 in an attempt to sort of straighten her out, get her out of the family and into maybe a more disciplined environment, and that went spectacularly wrong. Her grandfather, allegedly, was a very physically abusive drunk, and she ran away from that situation when she was 15.
And again, not really a children's right time period, so, I mean, fuck.
And then at the age of, it's not like it gets better from there. Then at the age of 17 in 1953, she gave birth to a son who was the product of, and I quote, a liaison with a married sailor.
Hey, sailor.
Yeah, hey, married sailor.
How old was she at the time?
She'd be 17.
She'd be 17. So with a married at 17, sailor. So if we follow these allegations that she's made and just say, okay, these are fact. And
this was a fact. She absolutely had a child.
Not just this. At 17. But the allegations against her family. So she's had it rough, if all of this is true.
Oh, yeah.
She's out on the street as a teenager. Pretty much gets picked up or whatever by this older man. How much older was he?
We know nothing about his actual name or his real identity. He's just identified as a married man who was a sailor.
So definitely older than 18.
Oh yeah, for sure. Not a fellow teen.
So basically another fucking predator gets his hands on her, knocks her up, and is she still living out on the street at this time?
I believe so. And in fact, she did give birth to the baby named David, and he was taken from Valerie at birth and placed for adoption, and she never saw him again. Because that was, again, very much a thing that happened to you back in the day. Yeah. You did not have rights, you know, people just took... Oh, I'm sorry, you know, you're an unmarried teenage slut. We're going to take your kid because you ain't going to give him no kind of life. What we're basically paraphrasing here is that there's been some stellar male role models in young Valerie's life. Real stand-up guys, patriarchy definitely coming out swinging for Valerie.
Yeah, and not only is it swinging, but it's connecting. Like, it has beat the fuck out of her so far.
Yeah, it has not been a great start to Valerie's life, but... Despite this absolute bullshit tsunami that young Valerie had to deal with, she was a real smart cookie. And she graduated from high school on time.
Wow.
Despite all of this bullshit, right? Besides a unplanned pregnancy, living on the streets, having her kid taken away from her, unsupportive, if not a downright abusive home life, bam, Valerie still graduated from high school. And, motherfuckers... She's going to put herself through college. Yeah, that's right. She puts herself through college at the University of Maryland, getting a degree in psychology and even joining the Psy-Chi Honor Society.
Wow.
Yeah.
I have to say, I am having a lot of respect for her right now.
Oh, but it gets better. She even hosted a radio call-in show while an undergrad, where she gave callers advice on how to combat men.
Wow.
Yeah, I know. Okay, guys, let me just say, she totally goes on to do a really terrible, terrible thing, but at this point in her life, I'm Team Valerie.
She's kind of a badass right now. Yeah. I have to say, she is kind of a badass. No, not even kind of. She is a badass. She put herself through school. She
overcame a shit ton, a metric shit ton of adversity, much of which was perpetrated upon her by individual men and by patriarchy. So you
kind of reminded me of my mom right now, actually. It's tripping me out.
Well, hopefully your mom didn't go on to shoot people.
No.
That's good.
Or, at least not that we know of.
Yeah. Maybe if she did, she was a better shot, and they never found the body, never found the rib cage. So that could be. She really did seem to be trying to make a go of it in a world that did not want her. She also, just to compound the difficulty she was going to face, came out as a lesbian in the 1950s, which was, as we said earlier, a truly shit-tacular time in American history to be queer.
Damn.
Yeah. I mean, we're still not hitting full equality, but remember, again, this is a time when you could literally be arrested just for who the hell you were.
That's true. That is very true.
But Valerie, again, she's a survivor. She's a survivor. She is. She decides that she's going to go to graduate school.
Went to graduate
school? She went to goddamn graduate school. Yeah, she did. She moved to Minnesota to go to the Graduate School of Psychology at the University of Minnesota, and she worked in the animal research lab for a while. She later did drop out of that program, however, and ended up moving to Berkeley, California to take some classes there. So, unfortunately, she did drop out of the University of Minnesota and moved to Berkeley, California, which was where everybody was moving in the 60s, because it was groovy, man.
Did she move to Berkeley to go to school at Berkeley, or did she just move there? Okay.
She took some classes, at least, there. But kind of that fell by the wayside as well, because she started working on her infamous Scum manifesto.
She had a manifesto.
Oh, she had a manifesto. Man. Don't you have a manifesto? Doesn't everyone have a manifesto they're working on?
I feel like I've been so misguided with my life.
No, just
what have I been doing?
Start working on a manifesto. It's the best excuse for not doing stuff. Like, hey man, do you want to come out and see my like cousin's band tonight? Sorry, I can't. I have to stay and work on my manifesto.
I love this.
Yeah, no.
This just needs to be... I don't care if I actually, like, make a manifesto or not. This is just an excuse.
You never finish your manifesto. It's a life's work. It's a commitment.
You know, all these people out there are crazy or are making all these manifestos, and I'm just over here, like, working on a podcast.
Yeah, no, dude, write a manifesto. It's what all the cool, crazy people are doing. Manifestos. Right. Yeah.
So after I burn the world down, you'll have something to go by.
Exactly. Like, well, she had a manifesto.
Of course.
I feel like it's also a great excuse for why you did crazy shit. Well, it was in the manifesto. I had to. Your manifesto is always about just burning the world. And the Scum manifesto is no exception to this manifesto rule.
Good title, though.
Right? The Scum, well, you know what Scum stands for?
Tell me.
The Society for Cutting Up Men.
Fuck.
Oh, yeah, now we're going to totally end up on the sort of 4chan red pill sites. They're man-hating lesbians. So our work here on the internet is done. Oh, no, the Society for Cutting Up Men, which didn't actually exist. It was more of a concept.
I don't want to cut up men.
I don't want to cut up pretty much anything.
True.
You know, even paper. I'm lazy. I don't want to do that. But no. It was the Society for Cutting Up Men. And the manifesto was basically Valerie's arguments for why men just straight up need to be taken out of the gene pool. Gay dudes and dudes that agreed with this, yeah, y'all can live. Just salt the earth of men. It's all for the ladies.
So, did we have... Wow, Neko is going crazy on a rug in the podfist, folks. She is being quite the active kitty.
She's over here fucking up the patriarchy.
She is. Fuck up that patriarchal rug, Neko. So, did they have, like, in the manifesto, did it explain if they had men that they kept around as just, like, breeders? Or what was the plan to propagate the human species?
I don't know that there was a plan for that. And we will get to some tiny excerpts from the Scum Manifesto later on, because I'm sure you're all quite curious. Just the list of grievances is the part that I'm like, wow, damn. I admit to not having completely read the Scum Manifesto. I've read excerpts from it, and it's definitely a manifesto. It's super manifesty.
Wow.
Some critics say, okay, it's a satire, it's not real, but Valerie's like, no, I mean this. I'm at least glad that she's let the gays live, because I would miss Drag Race.
Agreed. Agreed. Yeah. Rue. Oh, Rue is... I'm
pretty sure Rue's allowed to live.
Rue should be allowed to live on any earth.
So, anyway, Valerie jumped coasts yet again in the 1960s and moved to New York City, where she supported herself through panhandling, waitressing, and sex work.
Wait a minute. Now, didn't she receive a degree in psychology?
So, look, a lot of perfectly mental, and I'm not bagging on anybody that is suffering from mental health issues. Like, it's that the brain is a bodily organ. We are beset by many things in our lives. And remember, this is not a time either when taking good mental health care of yourself was encouraged or even spoken of.
No, I mean, that's so recent. I mean, anyone who listened to any of our episodes prior to this knows that we definitely believe in going and getting help, taking care of yourself mentally. Do it. Just if you need the help, go out there and do it and get the help. You don't write a manifesto.
I have to feel like physician heal thyself. You know, Valerie, you've studied abnormal psych, and yet, ding, 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 all the warning signs are that the call is coming from inside the house. There's a lot of strange decision-making happening. You can kind of start seeing Valerie traipsing down the path of paranoia.
I just find it very interesting that her choice, instead of working as a psychologist, was going into panhandling and sex work if she hated men and she was a lesbian. I mean, she's writing a manifesto against the patriarchy. That seems like something that would just push her that much. It's very self-defeating.
It does not seem like an obvious choice. Yeah. But, I mean, I think about the fact that she was also a very mannish-looking woman, which was very strange for the time. This is a time of extremely feminine, like, women couldn't even wear pants to work kind of thing. And she's got short hair, newsboys caps, pants. She's not going to be somebody that's necessarily wildly employable in white-collar circle. She just was very butch. Butch was, again, not a thing that we encouraged in women. Is that any kind of gender bending was very not cool.
I'm sorry, but during that time, what did they encourage in women other than to be in the kitchen popping out babies and making pies?
Pretty much. I mean, yeah. It was not a fabulous time to be a lady, and especially not a fabulous time to be a gay lady. So that's what she was doing in order to survive while she was living in New York and trying to write this manifesto and write some other works. And in fact, she was actually able to complete at least two pieces in 1965. One was an autobiographical short story that she actually was able to have published in Cavalier magazine.
Wow.
And it was entitled A Young Girl's Primer on How to Attain the Leisure Class. And it's supposed to be a fairly, I've never read it, I have to admit, I wasn't able to get my paws on it, but it's supposed to be a fairly satirical sort of take on kind of how she's managed her life so far. And then the other piece that actually ends up sort of being the catalyst for what comes next was a play that she wrote, charmingly and succinctly entitled Up Your Ass, which was the story of a young woman who is, quote, a man-hating hustler and panhandler who ends up killing a man. Wow, does life imitate art sometimes? Foreshadowing.
Or maybe she could see herself going that route anyway, and it was already on her mind?
It very likely was. So, one fateful day in 1967, Valerie encountered Andy Warhol outside of his famous factory in Lower Manhattan and handed him her script for Up Your Ass, as Warhol was at the time a really hot avant-garde filmmaker and producer of works. So, Valerie thought, this is the guy for me. This is going to be the one to produce my play Up Your Ass. So Warhol took her manuscript, complimented Valerie on how well it was typed, and promised to read and review it. So according to factory lore, Warhol had been having a lot of issues with his film screenings being busted by the cops for obscenity, even if you weren't actually seeing the blowjob happening, the fact that blowjobs were mentioned was a big deal. And there was also a lot of nudity, sexual content, things like that, in a time where this is not permitted. This is obscene, obscene, obscene. So upon reading this delicately titled Up Your Ass, he figured that it was so dirty, so pornographic, that it had to be a police sting operation to shut his filmmaking down once and for all. He thought that Valerie was the plant that was trying to entrap him.
Makes sense.
Yeah. There's a lot of paranoia that circles around and ends in a bad way in this. Valerie, meanwhile, waited a while and then contacted Warhol wanting to know whether he was interested in the play, and he told her that he'd lost it. So,
oh no.
Yeah. And so again, remember, this is 1967, and this is in the day before Xerox machines and Kinko's and ease of reproducing things. This is before computers. Everything was literally typed on a manual typewriter. And that was not an easy thing to make copies of. You could put carbons in there as you were typing, but in order to make multiple copies, you'd actually have to go to a lot of expense to get it copied, or you'd have to sit down and retype the whole goddamn thing again. She's not got the funds to be able to make more copies of this.
Not to mention all that time she has to spend typing it out instead of sucking dicks for type ribbon.
Sure. Yeah, this is a bad deal for Valerie. And Valerie, as we will find out later, is not somebody that deals with slights particularly well. So she basically demanded money to replace this lost copy, since she only had one other copy of it. And Warhol jokingly offered her a job as a typist at the factory. Hey, patriarchy, you're cute. Yeah, she did not take well to that. But, you know, Andy Warhol wasn't a total asshole. He did end up casting her in his movie I, a Man, and paid her $25 for that. So he did try to make it up. Now, he was not the smoothest operator. He was a really... He was a strange dude.
As fuck is yeah, what he was.
He was an awkward, strange guy. In interviews with him, he would often just answer questions with like, yes, no, maybe, I don't know. He was really into weird, flippant, kind of off-putting ways of interacting with people. So you can see where there might be a little tension there.
He was very awkward.
He was a weird dude. So the plot of I, a Man, was a parody of a really popular Swedish erotic film, I, a Woman, that had been rather a hit in the United States the previous year. So in I, a Man, the leading man, Tom Baker, who was an American actor principally known for being besties with Jim Morrison of The Doors. So in I, a Man, the leading man basically has sexual encounters with 8 different women in the film. Yeah. So Valerie's role in the film is listed as girl on staircase, and she doesn't actually have a sex scene with good old Tom Baker. She just has this conversation with him on a staircase in which she kind of turns him down and leaves him to fend for himself sexually by saying, I gotta go beat my meat. Yeah, she's saying, I gotta go beat my meat as she exits the scene.
I think I just want to exit every scene like that from now on. Like, you look at me, where are you going? I gotta go beat my meat.
Yeah, at work, you know, I'm heading for lunch. Oh, good. I gotta go beat my meat. Yeah, that's gonna go over pretty well with HR.
Daycare.
Oh, yeah, drop your kid off at daycare. Oh, bye, mom. Yeah, gotta go beat my meat. That's, yeah, church, all of that.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
When you're not working on your manifesto, just tell people you gotta go beat your meat.
Pretty soon, they will stop asking you to do things.
To do anything. They'll just stop calling at all. So, apparently, Valerie actually found this experience to be enjoyable and was really satisfied with the filmmaking process. She even ended up in a non-speaking role in another movie called Bike Boy that was made later that year. And her relationship with Warhol at this point was pretty cordial. That's gonna change, though. In the same year, 1967, Valerie self-publishes her infamous Scum Manifesto, and also had a fateful meeting with the Olympia Press founder, Maurice Girodius. Maurice Girodius. They were both living at the infamous Chelsea Hotel at that time. Now, good old Maurice, oh boy, he was kind of a shit. He really was. He was kind of a shit to his
With writers. A name like that, how could you not be? I mean, I feel like he should be in some kind of used car salesman suit and very, very greasy looking.
Yeah, kind of. His press was really known for publishing erotic works and works that really pushed the envelope of censorship. But he was also known as somebody who often didn't pay his writers and kind of took advantage of them. So at some point, she meets him at the Chelsea Hotel. And he gets her to kind of sign this contract that's kind of an informal contract in exchange for $500 that grants him her next work and other writings, kind of in quotes. She then kind of really starts to go off the paranoia rails here, just takes the crosstown bus to Wackyville. And she believes that having signed this contract, it means that Gerodius owns all of her works in perpetuity, and that there was a conspiracy between old Maurice Gerodius and Andy Warhol that resulted in him not returning her script to Up Your Ass. That he didn't actually lose it, that he was in cahoots with Maurice Gerodius to steal this particular work.
This makes perfect sense.
Yes. So
obvious, clear connection.
Absolutely.
I'm guessing that she saw them together at some point, and they had the same hangouts. And
I think they did have some overlapping circles, but it wasn't like they were BFFs. They might have encountered each other in the Chelsea Hotel, which was this kind of big melting pot for the avant-garde in New York. But there was never any kind of arrangement, formal or informal at all, between Warhol and Gerodius. None whatsoever. This is all kind of in Valerie's mind.
Clear connection between them, obviously.
So this is all basically background setup for what happens next. Dun dun dun! Cliffhanger!
Alright, so the way we are breaking this down for you today, folks, you know how we like to do our segments normally, where I will go right in the middle and Lynn will normally wrap up for us. But this time, since it is a two-parter, what we are doing is she's starting us off. I'm going to wrap us up for this episode and then you can pick it back up in the next episode. And yeah, that's how that one's going. So that's why you get a cliffhanger this time from Lynn.
Dun, dun, dun!
And for me, I am very excited about this episode.
Yeah, you went super deep. You went investigative reporter. You weren't like Barbara Walters' surface celebrity interview. You went Geraldo deep in this one. This is an expose.
I went deep into this dive, and it's because I am so fascinated by this person who I'm doing this on. And I'm not alone. She is as fascinating to me as H.H. Holmes is, and wait until I do that dive, because let me tell you what, that is going to be, like, straight in the fucking deep end, and I'm just gonna swim around there for a long time.
Yeah, you got, like, a dossier on that motherfucker.
I do. I really do. So, my story today is on the very, very famous Belle Ganesse.
Oh, good. I'm so excited.
Hell's Belle. The only person that fascinates me as much, well, almost as much as H.H. Holmes. And they're both around the same time, and they were both just as impressed.
Prolific. She's a prolific doer of horrible deeds.
She didn't
just dip her toes into the water of miscreancy. She went whole hog. Yeah. Whole way.
Full body
baptism of blood.
She did. She changed the perception people had on the evil that women could commit. I mean, she changed the opinion of an entire world about women and how ruthless and vicious they could be.
She was a pioneer of horrible things in many ways.
She was a pioneer of murder. She truly was. So, for those of you who do not know who Belle Ganesse is, sit back and enjoy yourselves.
It's gonna get bloody and fiery.
At the time this all happened, she received press coverage from around the world. This crime was everywhere. The sensationalism in the press caused a lot of misinformation, and that misinformation still persists to this day. In fact, some of it is so commonly told that you're going to notice me contradicting it in places. I will be correcting it, contrary to common belief.
The real dirt, not the fake news.
Exactly. As much as I could find, that is.
And this is, remember, this is stuff that a lot of this would have been lost to the mists of time, because this was over 100 years ago. And also, this was not a time where we had the kind of forensics like we do today, or the kind of record keeping that we do.
If you are interested in this case, I would recommend you reading Hell's Princess. Terrible name, but a great book. I mean, seriously, terrible name.
Hell's Princess. Hell's
Princess. I just imagine, like, some wafty woman sitting up next to Satan being like, Daddy, Daddy.
I want to go to the infernal debutante ball.
I need a new fire crown. Yeah. Hell's Princess. Great book. All right. Let's dive into this rabbit hole. Belle Ganesse was born Brynhild Palsdottir Storseth on November 11th, 1859, in Selbu, Norway. Now, if I mess up these names, guys, again, I am sorry, I try.
But you don't speak Norwegian?
No, and again, this southern accent in this tongue, just, they don't want to pronounce. See, they don't believe it.
Y'all can say cotillion, but Brynhild, that's a stretch.
That's right. I mean, let's face it, down in New Orleans, they have a street that in any other place would be called Calliope. Down there, it's called Calliope.
There is that.
It's a different world.
Hey, Portland's got what any normal person would call Couch Street, which would be ridiculous.
Cooch.
But Portland does them one better. Cooch Street. Where Cooch do you Street. Live? Cooch Street. Wow.
Brynhild was born into a large lower class family, and life was really rough on her growing up. I mean, can you imagine growing up at the turn of the century in fucking Norway to a lower class, large lower class family? That's a place where there's constant hard work and not a lot of food or comforts to go around. That's like, get up and work your ass off until you starve. And she had it rough growing up. But in Selbu, her origin story is well established, but it's not been proven. So I just want to point that out before pulling out my favorite word. Allegedly.
Allegedly.
Allegedly, in 1877, at the age of 18, a pregnant Brynhild went to a barn dance. I've heard some tellings say she went to confront the baby daddy, who was from a wealthy family, and force him to marry her. This story does ring a bit true, though, because of Belle's character. Based on the testimony of people who knew her well, she was very materialistic and had no problem using sex to her advantage. I don't mean like she was a vamp. Dear God, no, this woman was not a vamp. In fact, Belle was never known as a beauty. She was 5'10", and when she got older, weighed almost 280 pounds, or somewhere near 280 pounds. So she was a big girl. She had a wide, flat mouth, kind of like a frog, and it was very stern. She had a stern look about her.
Perhaps she was what the French call jolie laide, that sort of beautiful ugly that was sort of compelling. Somebody like an Uma Thurman, for instance. Like Uma Thurman, beautiful woman, but if you kind of look at the pieces all together, buggity eye, weird looking, kind of that Innsmouth look, if you're an H.P. Lovecraft fan.
She definitely was not even an odd beauty. No, she had tight, curly, mousy brown hair. And when she was younger, her eyes were pretty. She had very pretty eyes when she was younger, but not beautiful eyes, just
like not ugly eyes.
Exactly. The thing about her, though, was she was extremely charming. Much like, I think, Cleopatra when I think about Belle Ganesse, because, well, you know, Cleopatra was not a beautiful woman. She was actually quite plain, and she spoke in great skill, though. She was very cunning. She was good with linguistics. And
a cunning linguist.
Yes.
Man, I gotta make that joke. Sorry. Yeah. So it was more that she was like, she rolled plus 10 charisma.
Oh, yeah, totally. Totally. If she was rolling, she would be like an 18 plus 10.
Okay.
I mean, she was solid on her charisma. But as far as how she personally looked, she was no dazzler of men or vamp. So she's out at this dance, and the baby daddy, this rich bastard, decides to beat her and kick her in the stomach until she miscarries.
Oh, man, that's awful.
I know, right?
See, we're starting out sympathetic toward people that later go and do terrible things.
Yeah. And again, this is allegedly what happened. We don't have any proof of this, but it is in Selbu very well established from what I can tell. Selbu, if it is not, I'm so sorry. This is when she supposedly became distant and had a shift in her character. Her personality changed. According to everybody around her, she went from being a very kind person to somebody removed, almost. And a short while after this incident occurred, with that little fucker who kicked her, he died of...
Of murder?
Of stomach cancer.
Stomach cancer? Like, because there was a knife in his stomach?
Maybe there was arsenic in his stomach.
Oh, okay. Don't know. Yeah, arsenic works. Yeah, and poison, as we know, is definitely the weapon of choice for women.
Yeah, it is. It definitely is. So he, quote unquote, dies of stomach cancer. But you have to remember, this guy was probably a teenager in his early 20s at absolute most. So really, how likely was it that he died of stomach cancer if he died at all? It's like, who knows if he even existed.
Yeah. It's unknown.
So as the story goes, Brynhild went to work on a farm and saved up money to move to the U.S. And that might be partially true, but she also had help. Her sister Nellie had immigrated to the U.S. previously, and she helped bring her younger sister to Chicago. So in the tellings that I have heard from so many people, said that Brynhild had gone and she had worked on this farm and saved up her money and then came over to the United States. Well, again, that might be partially true, but Nellie really was the driving force for bringing her sister to Chicago.
So she actually had some family support. It wasn't just like she was a lone wolf.
Yes.
Doing everything on her own.
Yes. In fact, she and her sister were very close for quite some time. And in 1881, Brynhild immigrated to the United States, and like so many immigrants before her, changed her name to something that sounded more American, and she became Bella Peterson.
Okay. It's a little easier for the English-speaking tongue.
So Bella Peterson moved to Chicago with her sister, and within 3 years of moving, she married a man by the name of Mads Sorensen. So she married Mads in March of 1884 at an evangelical church in Chicago. He was another Norwegian immigrant, and he was a big man with a big thick neck and a handlebar mustache.
All the ladies love a handlebar mustache.
Oh, yeah. Back then, it was all the rage. It was like a thick handlebar mustache, too.
Thick, juicy handlebar mustache.
Free mustache rides.
With handlebars. Woo!
That's so you don't fall off.
Right?
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah, we're going to go there. We're potty mouths today.
Hey, we took a break. We had dinner. I have a little liquor in me now, so it's only going downhill from here, folks.
I'm high on lavender soda!
So, Mads worked in a department store, and according to Belle's sister, she was very much aware of what she wanted in a husband, and it wasn't the pulling of the heartstrings that drew her to Mads.
It was a handlebar mustache and his money.
Well, it was his ability to give her a better life. She was very entrepreneurial, I should say. She definitely looked out for herself and wanted to continue bettering her life.
Hey, because we are living in a material world, and Belle is a material girl. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, no, it makes sense.
Totally.
Yeah, if you come from a life of privation, you're gonna maybe be predisposed to wanting that capitalist dream, sure.
Exactly. And she was known for just being captivated by capitalism and material items everywhere. After she moved to the U.S., she went from Selbu, Norway to Chicago. You have to imagine the difference in those worlds, especially during that time period. Day and night, people, day and night.
Yeah, the streets weren't necessarily paved with gold over here, but they sure were paved with easy-to-come-by meats and produce and ready-made clothes and some real material comfort.
Yep. So the only thing Belle was ever commented on record saying about Mads was, he gave me a nice house.
Well, that's real romantic.
He gave me a nice house. It really puts into perspective where her thought process was there. But when they got married, she was 24 and he was 28. So there was a little bit of an age difference, but not much. And by all appearances, they were very happy. And contrary to popular belief, what everyone said about Belle was that she was very maternal. And I know those of you out there who are listening to this were like, wait, what? Because that is not what you hear. You don't hear that this woman was maternal. You don't hear that she went out of her way to help orphans, that all of the Sunday school children in the area, this district that they lived in with other immigrants in Chicago, knew her and she was taking care of them. You also don't hear that that is why she had a falling out with her sister. So her sister had 5 children. As you did back then.
Sure. It wasn't exactly the Nuva ring out there for you. No.
No, but you weren't popping birth control pills every time you turned around. You know.
And sex was still fun. So babies.
Yeah, babies. And she had 5 of them. And her youngest daughter, Belle, demanded to raise. I mean, not just asked, demanded that her sister give her her daughter so she could raise.
Because she just wanted a cute little doll to dress up, or just...
She just really wanted to be a mother that bad, and she wanted to raise her niece as her own. And so, of course, Nellie, her sister, like any mother probably would, was like, no.
You're not taking my baby.
No.
I'm gonna keep my baby. Well, this is a Madonna song for everything, really is. Isn't there?
Yeah. At least in Belle's life. I mean, maybe if there's a movie, that could be the soundtrack.
Oh, yeah.
So they have a falling out. She doesn't speak to her sister anymore, really. I mean, they see each other in passing later at funerals and things like that. But her sister was even nice enough to let Bella keep her daughter for 6 weeks, hoping that that would help her with this need that she had. But when she demanded to raise her as her own, she was just like, nope, and peaced out. So that ended that relationship in a really kind of sad way. So in 1891, Bella's dream of becoming a mother finally did come true, though. Now, this is one of those things where I'm going to say I have heard this a different way. I know that this is misinformation. It's due to misinformation that is out there. So Jenny Olson was adopted by Mads and Bella when she was 8 months old in 1891. Her father was Anton Olson. Now, people out there are like, well, we think she might have been this other child. No, no, it's well documented on how Jenny was adopted. Her mother was dying and was very close friends with Bella and Mads. And Jenny was given to Bella after she begged her, please give me your child. Let us raise your child. We'll give her a good home, and swore to God that she would take care of her. And later on, the father, after he remarried, Anton, after he remarried, tried to regain custody. And Bella even went to court and won the court case to keep Jenny as her legal daughter. She would take Jenny over to visit Anton frequently, and Anton said that she was always well cared for, very well dressed, and it was clear that the family loved her and took good care of her. So all of you out there that is, are like, well, we're not really sure where Jenny came from, that's not true. Even up to her death, Jenny wrote to her sister that she had through her father. So we know where she came from. But Bella ended up adopting Jenny. So here she's finally become a mother. Well, now this is when shit begins to get shady.
Uh-oh. There's always a turning point. Or they wouldn't be on the show.
No, no. It's not this happy fun time.
Yeah, this isn't lovely family interests.
No, no. We haven't done happy fun time, and we never will. So just be prepared.
I think the Necropants were a happy fun time for me.
Necropants really were a happy fun time. That was hilarious. The jeggings of the damned.
I mean, you make your own fun, right? Sometimes out of other people's legs.
So shit gets shady. They bought a candy store. They managed to save up and buy a candy store. And it was the Sorensen Candy Store in Chicago. Pretty cool, right?
Yeah. Oh, I mean, it sounds like things are going pretty well for the family. Nice house, good handlebar mustache, adopted kid, and they literally are kids in a candy store. That's great. Yeah. How can you lose when you run a candy store, right?
Well, guess what the candy store was near. Now, remember, we're in Chicago, turn of the century Chicago.
Oh, was it your favorite hotel?
It was right around the corner from the World's Fair Hotel, which, for those of you who do not know, is where H.H. Holmes was up to his shenanigans and hijinks.
Yeah, Chicago's kind of been a hotbed of murder for some time.
Really has. You have to wonder what's going on with the energy there. Anyway, so yeah, right around the corner from the World's Fair Hotel during the time it was active.
Nice.
That could have been a match made in hell. Can you imagine that?
I'm really glad there wasn't, like, Tinder for serial killers at the time. I'm just really glad that, my dad was at the Fry Art Museum, and that was where the Fries, Charles and Emma, who gave the name and the art to the museum, discovered their love of art was at the Chicago World's Fair. Happily, I don't believe they stayed at the World's Fair Hotel because they did, spoiler alert, they did not die. They went on to prosper, buy a shit ton of art, and then donate it and a museum to the city of Seattle. But again, there's a creepy connection there.
And you also don't really know because he didn't kill everybody.
Nope. I have no idea where they stayed. Yeah.
We don't know. Could have been there. Could have not been. Probably wasn't, but you know.
They might have stopped for candy at Sorensen's.
They might have.
Yeah.
Who knows? But unfortunately, the candy store, apparently not many people stopped there because it started doing very poorly in business. They weren't turning the profit that she thought they were going to. And as she was watching her money drain away, it's not very Belle-like to be okay with this. And one day when she and Jenny were alone in the store, I think Jenny was 3 or 4 at the time, suddenly Belle claimed a small kerosene lamp exploded, and she and Jenny come running out of the store screaming, "Fire! Fire! Help! Fire!" and watch the store burn down.
On a side note, it probably smelled really delicious, like burnt sugar as it went up. Yeah, so that's sort of nice for the neighborhood.
I mean, maybe like marshmallow.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my God. Like a delicious s'mores fire.
Oh, God. Yes. Oh, yeah. I'm all about that.
May all your house fires be s'mores fires.
Yes. So she runs out. And of course, the insurance company is going to investigate this, right?
Sure. That's what they do.
Yeah. They couldn't find any evidence that a kerosene lamp had exploded. They didn't find glass. They didn't find kerosene ignition points. Nothing. But they still paid out on the insurance policy.
Because Belle was charming?
Probably. She charmed her way in and out of everything she wanted to. So it could have been because she was charming. I'm not entirely sure. But they definitely got the money from it. And so they then took this money and bought themselves a house. A very nice house in an affluent area. And it was very lovely. And they continued living their lives. Now, during this time, there are two babies that we're not sure if Bella had them or if they were adopted. We don't really know. In fact, one interesting thing about her is we don't know if she ever had any of her children.
Oh, like biologically.
Mm-hmm. Or if they were adopted.
Because this was not a time of things like hospital births and carefully kept certificates and records and things like that at all.
This is a time where they had something called baby farming.
Oh, yeah. Baby farming sounds real cute. Like there's a cabbage patch. And the lovely baby farmer wanders through and gently waters all the cabbages that are growing babies with morning dew. That is not what happens
at a baby farm. That is not what happened. No, in fact, a lot of women who were, let's say, working women, seamstresses, housekeepers, who, again, no birth control, sex is fun. Either that or real rapey times, too.
Yep.
Maybe they were taken advantage of and they ended up impregnated. Didn't want to lose their positions. In a lot of places, you could not have a child and work. And they didn't want to lose their child. And so they would pay some kindly family or woman to look after their child when it really, they were paying them tuppence, and it was not a conducive way to raise a kid. A lot of those babies died. A lot of them died directly after, and those women were just killing them for the money. It was messed up. So it was probably real easy for her to get a baby when she wanted one. But two of these babies, between the years 1896 and 1898, passed away. Caroline at 5 months old due to acute colitis, which you know what acute colitis is, of course.
Oh, yeah.
For those of you out there who do not, basically just imagine yourself shitting yourself to death.
It's not a preferred way to go.
No. And what can often masquerade itself as acute colitis?
Is it arsenical poisoning?
It is. Ding, 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 ding. You got that.
Though, again, I'll play Belle's advocate here. I'll play Hell's Princess's advocate. It was also not a time of great hygiene or knowledge about food safety or electricity for refrigeration. And a lot of people did die of things that today you'd get some antibiotics for and be sent home because they didn't have antibiotics. They didn't have vaccines. They didn't have the kind of medicine and food and product safety like we do today. So, you know, maybe she did in poor Caroline, and maybe just the times did in poor Caroline.
It was a very, very high death rate for children back then. Very high. So who knows? Who knows what caused it? But she did get an insurance payout from it.
Oh, I'm beginning to sense a pattern here in Belle's life.
Well, keep sensing that pattern, because at 3 months old, little Axel dies of hydrocephalus. Hydrocephalus, hydrocephalitis. I've heard it several ways, but you know what? Basically, it's water on the brain. And I have seen this long, long, long time ago. I saw it in a child who was in a very poverty-stricken area, and it wasn't good to deal with it then.
Also, again, no modern medicine to help treat the child. So, goodbye, Axel.
Yeah. So, who knows if he died from that, or if he died from her poisoning him. She did get another insurance payout. So, see that. However, at this point, do we know if she's insured everybody? We don't know. We don't know. All we know is there's this woman who's lost two children in her candy
and
shop.
And a candy store.
And a candy shop in a house fire. And she and her husband are about to be scammed.
Uh-oh. Well, these are deathy times, so getting insurance on everybody you know, including the cat, is probably a good idea.
Yeah. One day, this gentleman makes a proposition to Mads. He is a representative of a mining company that is doing gold mining up in Alaska.
Which was a very popular thing to be doing at the time.
It was. It was.
Gold rush times. Yep.
Yep. A lot of people were making their fortunes off of it. And he wanted to employ Mads to go up to Alaska and mine for gold. And they would give him a very healthy salary every week. And they would even pay Bella every week for the loss of her husband, because they were taking away their father, the family breadwinner, and all of that, and her husband. So they were going to compensate her as well. And I'm sure she thought, damn, I'm smooth getting this deal set up, right?
Because it wasn't like she really liked having Mads around so much anyway.
Yes. So they signed this agreement, and if Mads does not adhere to his portion, they basically have signed over their house.
Okay.
Yeah.
Doesn't sound like an up-and-up sort of work-for-hire kind of contract.
I know, right? Months go by, they're getting ready, getting him outfitted for Alaska, you know.
Buying long johns and hardtack.
And pick, maybe a goat.
Ooh, one of those little pans for mining gold.
Definitely a pan. Had to get a pan. That is a must-have for going up to Alaska. So they get all this. They got the goat waiting. They've got the pan. They keep on looking at the door like, when is Mads going to get out of here? And they wait. And they wait. And the time period is rapidly approaching where they have to have a certain amount met of him having found this gold before they are encroaching upon their deal. And so they start doing some digging into this company, and they find out that it is a defrauding company. It's a total scam. And they have taken the promissory note on the house and turned it over and sold it to a real estate agent who, if they cannot pay the $800, and at that time, $800 was a lot of money.
Like a squillion dollars.
Yes.
Yeah.
If they cannot pay, actually, I think it was something like $3,000 or I don't know. But let's go with $3 billion.
It was a lot more than they had lying around.
Yep. If they couldn't pay that $800, he was going to own their house. So they went to court and won, surprisingly. Won. And I'm not entirely sure if what happened next happened right before they won or happened after they won. But on Tuesday, April 10th, 1900, a house fire breaks out.
Ooh, I see a pattern.
Yeah.
Man, really. I feel smart.
So a house fire breaks out, and according to the newspaper articles at the time, the fire, because it was in the newspaper, the fire department declared that it was caused from a faulty heating apparatus.
Not a kerosene lamp that was carelessly exploding everywhere?
No, no. Faulty heating apparatus. And so the fire burned their house, but it didn't completely burn it down. It just destroyed everything on the inside. But fortunately, guess what?
Was it insured?
It was insured.
Oh, see, Bella's not smart enough to actually look into the financials of the mining company she's potentially signing her house away to, but she is smart enough to get insurance on literally everything in her life.
Everything. Literally everything has insurance. In fact, everything has insurance so much that due to a changing in policies, Mads, on one day, has insurance that overlaps from two different companies. Life insurance.
Like a double payout?
Like a double payout day.
Ooh, I would watch your back that day, Mr. Mads.
Well, he didn't. He probably didn't even know about it, really. Poor Mads. On that day,
that fateful day,
and what a coincidence, just happens to pass away from having an enlarged heart, right?
Was it enlarged with arsenic? Stuffed full of arsenic?
Isn't everything stuffed full of arsenic? I mean, this story, I look at things and I'm just like, that is heaping with arsenic right there.
I think even the house fires were probably started with burnt arsenic.
That's right. Arsenic starts it all. Unfortunately, Mads dies on July 30th of 1900. So he made it over a decade with living with this woman and married to her. But yeah. And 1900, on the day that his insurance policy overlapped, he died.
So basically, Belle was like, you know what? That handlebar mustache is pretty sweet. With double insurance money, I can buy my own set of luxury handlebar mustaches for my own use. So you gotta go, Mads.
Yes, that is exactly what she was like. That is exactly it. That sums it up perfectly. Mads passes away, and they call one doctor first. They actually had two doctors examine him. And Bella gives them her story about how he wasn't feeling well, and she gave him a tincture, this powder, and made it into a tincture, and gave it to him to feel better, and then he died. Upon looking at the body, the first doctor thought that there were telltale signs of arsenic poisoning.
From the tincture, no doubt.
You would think. This first doctor who came and looked at everything was a former boarder of theirs. I don't know if he was a boarder at the time because they did take in boarders, or if he had just recently moved or something, but he came to look. And then the family doctor shows up. And the family doctor and this boarder confer together and decide, you know, he has an enlarged heart, and the poor widow Ganesh, who is just bereft, can't take any more. And in their theories, they're thinking maybe the druggist had given her the wrong medicine.
Oh, okay. Gave her, like, rat poison instead of husband medicine.
Mm-hmm. Or morphine, and he OD'd on morphine, something like that. And they didn't want to break her heart anymore and tell her these things.
That's sweet.
Yeah. So, of course, it was filed as an accident. He had an aneurysm and he was buried. But before he was buried, his brother was like, that's some horseshit.
It's glad that at least somebody in this story is paying attention, because mm-hmm. doctors and insurance companies really don't seem to be.
Nope, nope. And so he wanted an autopsy done. And they told him, sure, you can have... Now, again, anyone who knows the story really well is sitting there going, well, they don't know if an autopsy was ever done or why it wasn't. But we know an autopsy was not done. And the reason it was not done is because it would have cost $300 to have it done. And his brother would have had to pay for it and didn't have the money.
And that would have been like thousands of dollars in today money.
Exactly. So there was never an autopsy performed. He was buried. And at the funeral, like a freaking 5-year-old, Bella was putting her face in her hands and sobbing very loudly, and occasionally would peek through her fingers to see how people were taking her sorrow.
Wow. So again, like Madonna, terrible actress. The parallels are really impressive here.
quite. Yeah, that was shady. I mean, it was just straight out shady. So, now a widow, and she has several children at this time. She, and again, we don't know if they were actually Mad's children or if they were adopted, what happened there. So, she decides that she is going to, right after the funeral, like 2 days later, she collects on those double life insurance policies, which equate to today's money about $250,000.
Well, that's a pretty sweet payout.
Yeah, that was a pretty sweet payout. And she takes that money and decides that she is going to get herself a hog farm.
Oh, yeah, that's what you do with your windfall.
Yeah, right?
Get yourself a hog farm.
You know, my mama used to tell me, always fear a man with a hog farm. However, we're super Southern, and they also have a saying, and my family went to shit and the hogs ate him. So on the way to get the farm, she dropped the A from her name and it became Belle, the more popular American version. So yet again, she's changing herself. And while getting the hog farm, she also stopped in to see their old boarder, the newly widowed Peter Gunness.
Ooh, I see where this is going.
Do ya?
Wow, I feel so smart.
So Peter was a real looker. He actually was. Like, he was a really good looking man. And he was one of their old boarders. So she knew him. And his wife had just died in childbirth to their second child. Now, the baby didn't make it, but he still had his first daughter, Swanhild.
Ooh, I love that name. Swanhild.
That's going to be my new pen name, Swanhild.
Swanhild. I want to make Swanhild happen.
Me too.
Like, I'm tired of, like, Taylor and Madison and Brooklyn and Cannon. All those Apple, you know, all the cool baby names. Let's go back in time and just go with Swanhild.
You know, guys, if you're out there and you are about to give birth, give consideration to Swanhild, because we could really bring this back.
Oh, yeah. We're bringing Swanhild back. We're making Swanhild happen.
It's happening. Little yeah. Swan. Hildy.
Oh, yeah. Swanny, Hildy, Swanhildy.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I like it. All right. So, Swanhild. Best name ever. And her father end up living with Belle. And now there's this very wealthy, you know, handsomely wealthy widow woman who owns this beautiful hog farm, because this place really was she in its time. It's in LaPorte, Indiana, first off, which is near Chicago, but, you know, not close enough to be a suburb. It's a ways out there. In fact, it had been a brothel, a very nice brothel.
Ooh. With,
I know, right?
Not a pig brothel. No. That's going to a place that I don't think even we want to go.
I think we can pass on that
okay.
one.
That not a pig brothel.
Yeah, that'll be never be a topic of ours. No, no.
I mean, we might go into Bigfoot porn later on, but...
Solid.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's an imaginary creature. Maybe.
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 I mean, maybe that's why we never see Bigfoot, is he's making that mad porn cash and can hide out, like, in the legit. Anyway, so it was a brothel, though, just like a very nice upscale brothel, one of the nicest ones in the area. And before that, this farm has some history. It was a host to these outlaws, and it was just all kinds of wackiness. So,
to be fair, a lot of old houses did have storied histories. The house in which I currently live really was, honest to God, also a brothel.
See?
Yeah.
See, guys, you never know. Your house could be a brothel. So, she buys this beautiful former brothel, turns it into a pig farm, marries Peter Gunness.
As you do.
As you do. Brings Swanhild out with her children. And what do you know? As soon as they get there, several of the outbuildings burn.
What is with this woman and fire?
She obviously has a fire demon following her.
She just really believes in the cleansing power of fire.
Mm. And the money that comes with it, with the insurance policy.
Were these insured outbuildings?
They were insured outbuildings.
Of course they were. She's just prudent and careful.
She's something. As shady as things were getting, they're about to become a whole hell of a lot shadier. One evening, she and Peter are sitting around the house doing their thing, and she goes up, tucks the kids into bed, and he goes over to put his shoes by the fireplace where there's this big vat of hog brine that's cooling in the back.
Piping hot mug of hog brine. Nothing like it.
know. Doesn't that sound just...
The smell alone. Ugh.
Fun fact. Belle, at this point, would toss around, like, 200-pound hogs like a sack of flour.
She was burly.
She was a very... She was stacked.
Ripped like Jesus.
Yes. Her story that she gave at this point is very questionable. She had been making sausage with a meat grinder. So keep this in mind. There is a meat grinder in play.
Is this Chekhov's meat grinder where if you mention a meat grinder in Act 1, someone will end up, like, in it or murdered by it by Act 3?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
All right. So meat grinder. She meat grinder. Uses it. She brines some hog grinder and whatever. Some
hog rind bits.
Or whatever. The hog bits. There are hog bits in a pot or something like that. But there's hot hog juice somehow
again,
involved.
We are totally the podcast that turns you vegan.
Don't put that in your mouth.
Do not put anything we mention on this podcast in your mouth ever. Hot hog juice. Probably you can drink it. Please don't. For the love of all that is decent and holy, do not drink the hot hog juice. Not that an icy, cold, frosty mug of hog juice sounds any more appealing, but just maybe juice doesn't come from pigs. It can, but it shouldn't.
So, there's hot hog juice, a coolin. So the hot hog juice is a coolin, and she took this meat grinder and put it up on the shelf, and... then went about her business. And as she's going about her business, allegedly,
my
favorite word again, Peter somehow manages to spill this hot hog juice all over his head and neck.
By, like, dunking his head in the brine, or...
some kind of accident where he was putting his shoes over there, grabbing something, and he had tipped the hot hog juice over onto his head and his neck, and he starts screaming because he's burnt himself, and he's calling out, Mama, help me, I burnt myself, and she comes back and is doctoring this wound, and she notices that the meat grinder is on the floor, but she's more concerned with this burn on the back of his neck and around his ear, because that's what's hurting. According to Bella, she noticed that there was a spot on the back of his head where he had an injury as well, but he was talking about how bad it burnt. Oh, Mama, it burns. So she was taking care of that. She wasn't as worried about the injury on the back of his head. And they decide together that he's going to sleep downstairs, where it's easier to take care of his injury. And after a while, she goes upstairs and goes to bed with the children. Lays down with the children. And at some point during the night, little Jenny shows up at the neighbor's door. She ran over to the neighbor's house in her nightgown and tells them to send for the doctor that Papa's burnt himself. So they send and fetch for the doctor, and they go up to the Gunness farm, and when they get there, the neighbors, and eventually the doctor, Peter is there dead on the floor. He has a head wound on the back of his head, the meat grinder is lying near him, and his nose is broken.
Yet there wasn't a broken nose when we started this tale.
Nope. And did you hear me mention anything about a burn?
No burns.
So the doctor comes and the neighbors are leaving. And when the neighbors leave, even the younger boy comments to his dad on the way back to their farm that he thought it looked like a murder. And the father told him, boy, don't say that too loud or there's going to be trouble for the widow Gunness.
Okay, so they were like, nah, we're just going to hush that up. Let's just not get involved, shall we?
Let's just not get involved. However,
we saw a rib cage on the side of the road. Let's just not call the cops.
Let's run the opposite direction.
Sure.
Yes. So, they go back to their farm. The doctor is there. He hears out Belle's story, who is just inconsolable. He is so upset. She's lost Peter. And she is just inconsolable. So he hears her story and takes the body back, looks him over, you know, does his exam on the body, and comes to the conclusion that he did not have any burns. And his head had actually been bashed in. He had this huge... gaping wound in the back of his head, and his nose had been broken as if smashed in the face or if he landed on something like a lip of, let's say, a stone stair or something like that. So he's pretty messed up. And yet Belle had never mentioned anything about that. So he called an inquest, and Belle actually had to stand in front of a jury and convince them what had happened, that it had been a terrible, terrible accident. And she claimed there were blisters and a burn by his ear. The children had to stand up and give testimony. And Ginny, little Ginny, was one of the key witnesses to this. The thing is, though, the children's testimony was clearly coached. It was clearly coached. It was almost an exact recount that Belle gave. And in some areas, they should not have known the information that they did. She was so charming, though, that they let her off.
Seriously?
Seriously.
Wow, that's one dumbass inquest jury.
Yeah. Well, and she also claimed to be pregnant at the time, which there's some question about that. I mean, when she did have her baby, the supposed child, Philip, of Peter Gunness, she was 43 at the time. And the baby, when he was born, looked several months old. He looked too old to be a newborn. And neighbors actually saw her in the pig pens chasing pigs and running around the day after she gave birth.
Yeah, that seems a little fishy. I mean, I guess he could just be like a reverse premature baby. Is that a thing? Medically?
All I know is that's some fishy shit. And if you have a baby that's that big, you are not, from the medical field that I know, you are not out in a hog pen throwing around 200-pound hogs like a sack of flour the next day.
No matter how many Kegels you've done in preparation, you will be tore up from the floor up.
You will barely be walking down the fucking hall. And it's not like this is modern medicine that we were dealing with.
No, ma'am. No epidurals.
No. So there are some questions on if she actually adopted the baby. And at the time, there were questions on if she did. But things
she
happen.
Does have a habit of randomly collecting other people's children.
Again, we don't know if any of her children were actually biologically her children. So Peter dies. She collects the insurance. However, remember how I said Belle is very cunning. She's very intelligent. And she's very self-serving. Well, if you're an intelligent, cunning, self-serving woman, what do you see happening here? Do you see yourself continuing to get married and kill people? Because they're on to you now. You have stood in front of a jury.
Yeah, you get like two husbands that you mysteriously kill in strange circumstances, max. I feel like one, shame on you. Two, maybe shame on me. I don't know. Yeah, I think two is pretty much, you're really pushing your luck at this point.
Really pushing it. And she recognized that. And so he was actually her last husband.
So she took up a legitimate life working like in an office, say, or becoming a selfless social worker, or none of those things? No?
Is this happy fun times?
It is not.
No, this isn't happy fun times. But I'm going to leave that as your cliffhanger, dear listener, until our next episode. So, thank you for listening very much.
Alrighty,
we appreciate
remember
you.
What
we'll
I always like to
time.
Say. If you're a hater, then don't be a rater. However, if you like what we're doing and want to help us spread the disturbing word, then hit a like, subscribe, and leave a nice review. If you want to contact us, then you can reach us at disturbinginterest@gmail.com, at our website, disturbinginterest.com, or you can send us items for unboxing videos at P.O. Box 70515, Seattle, Washington, 98127. Find us on Patreon if you're feeling super generous, and remember, you might be disturbed, but you're not alone.